counsel for our second case may approach, and while you are doing that, I will call the matter and give you a few introductory comments. That is A230559, Moore versus Commissioner of Public Safety. Counsel, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second of six cases on our calendar today, December 20, 2023. You both are familiar with our proceedings. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I ask that you state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. Also, let us know how you'd like us to reference you this morning. And counsel, with that, as soon as you're ready, take your time. We are ready for you. I should just also note that these matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Christopher Perske, P-E-R-S-K-E. I represent appellant Mr. Moore. Mr. Moore's behalf, he appreciates the court's consideration of this case today. He would be in appearance in attendance today, but I received information that he is hospitalized, recovering from complications from a medical procedure, and intends to review the audio-visual recording in due time. So he appreciates that. This case is on appeal from a district court order stating a revocation of Mr. Moore's driver's license. The heart of this issue is the issue of physical control. The district court determined that Mr. Moore was in physical control of the vehicle. The facts were undisputed, and the district court's order outlines the relative positions of the parties and those undisputed facts that court relied upon in making the order. Those facts are in pertinent part.
Mr. Perske, before you go into the facts, I guess, would you disagree with me if I were to say that I think the district court concluded that there, and I'm reading paragraph 53, that there is probable cause to believe that Moore was in control of a motor vehicle?
That is the first part of the two-part issue in this case.
Right. So I mean, you initially said the issue is physical control. I think there are two different issues potentially, physical control and probable cause. Probable cause, of course, for physical control. But you've raised both issues on appeal.
And both issues were raised at the district court level.
Let me ask, did the district court decide both issues in your view or only one?
In my view, the district court considered or decided only one, which was the probable cause issue, and not whether or not the state had met its burden to prove actual physical control. It was referenced, and the district court acknowledges it earlier in the order, but the conclusion is clear. It's only dealing with this issue of probable cause. And this court can review issues of law de novo, but the court also has the ability to remand back to the district court for further findings if that order is incorrect or incomplete.
Okay, thank you for your answer. I just wanted to orient, you know, you and us at the outset to kind of be clear. So I think it's useful if we be clear about which issue of the two we're talking about.
And thank you. That is a critical point, that these two-step process or the two-step analysis was referenced by the parties, and the district court issued that the order that we have on appeal now. The facts that were presented in the record at the district court level are largely undisputed between the parties. In that Mr. Moore was found asleep in the passenger seat of a running vehicle with his shoes off, his sweatshirt turned around, hooded sweatshirt turned around backwards, and the remote key starter found not on his person, but in the back seat of the vehicle. In addition, two other individuals that were traveling with the vehicle were found not in the vehicle, but some short distance away from the vehicle. The parties had been traveling together. And so the district court determined that based on the simple fact that Mr. Moore was in the vehicle asleep in the passenger seat and could wake up, could put on his shoes, could turn his sweatshirt on around, could move over to the driver's seat, and could then operate the vehicle, he was considered in physical control for the purposes of probable cause.
Is there an unresolved factual issue that the district court would need to resolve in order to determine whether he was in physical control of the vehicle as opposed to probable cause? And the factual issue being as follows. The officer testified, I think a couple of times, that your client said that he drove the vehicle at some point in time, removed the vehicle at some point in time. And I think your client testified that what he meant by that statement was that the vehicle was moved, but he did not drive it. And that seems to me to be some question about whether he had ever been in physical control of that automobile at the time that he was intoxicated.
It doesn't
seem like it was resolved by the district court.
It was that information. Yes, there was one line, and it was included in our, I believe, in our reply brief. There was one line of testimony regarding that, and Judge, Your Honor is correct that it exists. And then Mr. Moore's later testimony in the record tries to, you know, explain a little bit. So there is that factual distinction. The district court heard that testimony, incorporated it into its findings of fact, but that did not come into its analysis in the conclusion.
I understand. I mean, keeping in mind that it only resolved the probable cause issue, it didn't resolve the physical control issue.
Right.
So when you mentioned earlier that we could remand the case for findings on the physical control issue, would a resolution of this factual distinction that exists in the record that doesn't seem to be resolved by the district court be necessary?
I don't believe so, and the reason was the argument at the implied consent hearing by the state, as referenced in the district court order, was not that Mr. Moore was driving or in control, driving or behind the wheel. The state's position at that time was his mere presence in the vehicle, as the court described, was sufficient to establish physical control for the purposes of a license revocation.
So whether he drove the vehicle at some point in time is a red herring in your view?
It is, very much so. I'm referencing to paragraphs 39 through 41 of the district court's order. The court laid out our arguments pretty succinctly. You know, appellant or Mr. Moore believes this was his argument, and the pertinent fact there was regarding the state's position. I have it right here, and then I'll. Respondent argues that the mere presence of Moore in a vehicle when the vehicle is operational can be moved satisfies the requirement to be in physical control of the vehicle without regard to intent. So that was our issue. That was what the district court.
Counsel, what I'm struggling with is the district court finding says. Officer testified that Mr. Moore said, "I parked the car." Mr. Moore testified, "Oh no, here's what I meant." It seems to me that regardless of whether the theory is driving or control, if the district court had resolved that factual dispute, in other words, if the district court said, officer testified that Moore said he parked the car, I believe the officer, I find Moore parked the car, wouldn't that finding be relevant to whether or not he had control of the car? I mean, is there any case law that says you can't go on a control theory, your theory being that he operated the vehicle, even though you haven't charged operation or sought revocation based on operation?
I was processing the first part of your question.
So to me, it seems that a decision regarding whether or not Moore parked the car is relevant to a determination whether or not he was in control, regardless of the fact that the DWI and the revocation wasn't based on operation. So is there any reason that control can't be based on operating?
I don't have any reason to believe. I mean, I believe physical control could be
based on I parked the car. I mean, I'm imagining a situation where they're driving down the, and there's nothing in the record, but they're driving down the highway. Moore says, you're too drunk, I don't want you driving my car. They pull over, the two walk away, you know, Moore pulls off and goes to sleep. I mean, that doesn't seem so unreasonable. So to me, it seems important to have a decision whether or not Moore parked the car.
That is possible. That wasn't what the state argued at the implied consent hearing. Or
okay, but they're referencing it here on appeal.
Yes.
And we would decide this issue de novo. So if we would think that fact was relevant, are you saying we can't consider it? And I mean, obviously, if the district court were to have said, I think Moore misspoke, there I find that he did not park the car. That would take us in a different direction.
That is true. Yes. That determination, which is a credibility determination, a fact determination, that is the purview and the scope of the district court finding those facts, would be a different analysis here on appeal again. And if I believe. I believe that it would be a more difficult argument. I will concede it would be a more difficult argument that Mr. Moore had and maintained his passenger status, as we've argued, mm-hmm. if there was a finding that he left the passenger seat, got into the driver's seat, parked the car, got back into the passenger seat, and fell asleep. Those facts would lean more towards some of the other established case law. A finding of operation or physical control. So that was not.
I'm not sure if the officer's testimony was that he drove the car after it was. I don't think it was parked twice. I don't think that was the officer's testimony. I'm looking at page 17. The officer said he stated that they were traveling and he had ended up parking it here where the vehicle was, and then he stated that his friend was driving. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what to make of that, but there was a reference, I don't know. Wait, what's your interpretation of that testimony?
My interpretation of the testimony in that brief snippet was that the officer, there was some, at no point, and the officer conceded at no point did Mr. Moore, or, well, he said he parked the car, but Mr. Moore was adamant throughout the other rest of the interaction that his friend was driving. So that's consistent with the officer's testimony, the two things there. It is my opinion an interpretation that Mr. Moore did not acknowledge being behind the wheel and him actually doing any of the actual driving or manipulation of the vehicle.
If we were to remand this case for further findings by the district court on the issue of physical control, do you have a view as to whether the district court should reopen the record to hear additional evidence about that subject?
The record as it stands right now was so incomplete. I believe there were two additional witnesses that were subpoenaed that did not appear. I believe that information appears in the record, in the transcript as well. That testimony would likely be very, very useful.
Can you remind me, was this a Zoom hearing?
It was, yes. It was held by Zoom, yep. And so Absent additional facts, it is appellant's belief and an argument here today that as a matter of law, those circumstances in which the officer found Mr. Moore, as related by the district court, do not lead to a finding of either probable cause to believe that he was in operational or in physical control, excuse me, or that he actually was in physical control. That those facts, they're absent the record that we were talking about. There's simply nothing to indicate that Mr. Moore had taken the steps, or the fact that he could take the steps. That argument is a very, very difficult one to sustain going in perpetuity for the residents and citizens of Minnesota. Most notably, for example, a passenger sitting in the car waiting for his friend to come back from a convenience store is deemed, under this situation, is deemed in physical control under these facts.
Well, and counsel, and perhaps you can address this in rebuttal.
Yes.
You rely heavily on Shane, and
yes.
Shane sets forth this rule. If it's a known passenger, he or she is not in actual control, physical control, unless they can start the vehicle without much difficulty. It's a little bit, it's a different standard. But we have a known passenger in Shane. The police stop the car. They see who's driving. They see who the passenger is. There's no dispute that Shane was the passenger. Here, there's circumstantial evidence indicating Moore was the passenger, but there's some also testimony that suggests, well, maybe he did have control. Maybe he gave up that passenger status. So I'm just looking for you to explain to me how we apply Shane and determine de novo that Moore was a known passenger, given the findings we already have, which include a finding that he testified that he had parked the car. That's my hurdle. So perhaps you could address that on rebuttal.
I will do that. My time's expired, so I'll address it on rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank
You'll
you
have
5 minutes
for rebuttal.
Very good.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Linnea Van Pilsen Bloom. I am an assistant attorney general for the state of Minnesota, and I am here on behalf of respondent, the commissioner of public safety. Please feel free to address me however you'd like. Counselor Ms. Van Pilsen Bloom is fine. The heart of the question before the court today is whether a person who is alone in their running car with the keys is in physical control of that car. The district court correctly concluded that it was more likely than not that appellant Mr. Moore was in physical control of his car. First, he was in the position where he had the ability at any point to set out on an inebriated journey, making his car a source of danger to himself and to the public. Second,
counsel, I'm sorry, before you, if I can stop you right there, I think you said the district court made a conclusion about physical control. Could you, with reference to the order, could you please tell me where it appears? Which paragraph are you looking at?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court explicitly stated that the officer had probable cause in the paragraphs that you, I believe, pointed out earlier. The court made sufficient factual findings to support that it was more likely than not that appellant was in physical control. And then to address your question more specifically, the legal conclusions, I would point to paragraph 51, where the district court stated Moore had the means to initiate movement of his vehicle. And at the end of that paragraph stated, had Moore awoken before the officer arrived, he would have had immediate access to drive the car. He had the immediate ability to make his vehicle a source of danger, necessarily coming to the conclusion that Moore was in physical control of his car.
And just to be clear, the words physical control do not appear in 51, right?
That is correct. While the words physical control do appear in the paragraphs where the court also discusses probable cause, the paragraph 51 parrots the language that is used to determine whether or not a person is in physical control in the case law. So in coming to those conclusions, it necessarily decides that Moore was in, an appellant was in physical control. However, should this court disagree that there are not sufficient factual findings or conclusions, I would echo appellant's statement that it is possible or would be appropriate to remand to the district court, as this court did in Hansen versus the Commissioner of Public Safety, in a similar situation. Lastly, I would just point out on the issue of whether the court decided whether or not Moore was in, or Mr. Moore was in physical control of his car, was that in paragraphs 46, 47, and 48, the court does employ the use of case law that addressed whether or not a person was in physical control of their car. And some of the facts that the court used that were persuasive to it are the fact that when the deputy found appellant Mr. Moore, he was stretched throughout his car from the front passenger seat where his lower half was to the back seat of the car. His waist was over the center console and the top half of his body was in the back seat.
Are you disputing that he was a passenger in the vehicle?
There is...
That's a yes or no. He was a passenger or he wasn't a passenger?
Your Honor, at the time when he was found, he was not a passenger. He may have been a passenger earlier in that day, but he had relinquished that passenger status.
And how did he do that? Because when he was found, he was passed out.
Yes, Your Honor. Per Starfield, whether a person is a passenger is determinative based on the whole overall situation. Specifically, a passenger is merely along for the ride. There were a number of steps that appellant took that relinquished his passenger status. First, the record shows that...
Can I just ask it a different way?
Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. So if you're in a car, you're either driving the car or you're a passenger in the car, right? You're one or the other. Or are you something else?
Your Honor, there is case law, for example, in Ives, where a person was deemed to be in physical control of a car when he reached over when somebody else was driving and pressed a pedal.
I'm not asking about, you know, you could be a passenger and a driver, right? You could be a passenger, a driver, or a passenger and a driver. You got three categories, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what is the evidence that he was a passenger and a driver?
Yes, Your Honor, and to specifically, I might say, be a passenger and be in physical control.
I'm not asking about physical control. You're either a passenger or a driver.
Okay, so the evidence to show that he was a driver, as Your Honor stated, was the fact that he told the deputy he parked the car.
Do we have a finding on that from the district court?
We do not have an explicit finding on whether or not he parked the car, but it is in the record and in the court's order that he told the deputy. There is a finding that he told the deputy that he parked the car.
Isn't there a finding that the deputy testified that Moore told the deputy that he had parked the car?
Your Honor, I believe on paragraph 18, the finding is that Moore explained to the officer that they were traveling and he ended up parking the car. So I believe there's a finding that he told, that Mr. Moore, appellant, told the officer he parked the car.
And Moore also said his friend was driving.
Yes.
And does that, I mean, I'm wondering whether that finding is an accurate reflection of the officer's initial testimony. Because the officer didn't say he ended up parking the car. I think it was that, well, I guess maybe so. He stated that they were traveling and he had ended up parking it here. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And just briefly to get back to Your Honor's question of him no longer being a passenger, again, in that it is determinative of the entire situation. The record shows that appellant, upon realizing that the person he had testified that he gave permission to drive his car was also too intoxicated to drive the car, he yelled at him and instructed him to pull off the road. The court did find that appellant fell asleep in his car only after they had pulled off of the interstate. And There's also evidence that he testified he went to sleep in the passenger's seat with the seat reclined, and then wound up, when he was found, the court found that he was, like I had explained earlier, stretched throughout the car, where the key to the car was in close proximity to his upper body in the back seats.
It's a little concerning to me to use a passenger's statement to an intoxicated driver to pull over as an exercise of physical control over the vehicle, because then you have, I think, something that might be incongruous with what the purpose of the Office of Public or the Office of Department of Public Safety is trying to accomplish, which is to keep drunk drivers off the road.
Yes, Your Honor, and it is the overall situation that is cumulative in this matter. After instructing his friend to stop driving and knowing that nobody in that car was able to drive it, again, it was his car. He fell asleep in the car and was in that car with the keys while intoxicated and had the ability at any minute and was the only person in that position when he was found to exercise control over the vehicle to set out on an inebriated journey at any minute.
And would you say that he would have the ability to do that without too much difficulty? Is that that's what the evidence shows?
That is what the evidence shows.
And how do you square that with the evidence that the officer banged on the window and wasn't able to rouse him? He was passed out cold, opened the door, yelled at him, wasn't able to rouse him, and then had to go all the way around to the back seat of the car, open the back seat of the car, and yell right by his head to wake him up. So that seems to me to indicate that there was a lot of difficulty in changing Mr. Moore's status from a passed out state to an awakened state such that he would be able to operate a vehicle.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, he did take a little bit of time to be awoken. I believe that that the legislature wrote the law so that it was able to be applied at its most broad with physical control. Starfield recognized this in that a drunken person's intent is not always reliable, and should a person who got in or was put in a car and is actually sleeping at that time awake and decide to drive at that time, that is the danger that the law is trying to avoid. I'd further note that there isn't an actual requirement that somebody intend to drive. That is not. And so in that instance, the fact that had he awoken on his own accord at that time, he was the only person in the car, he would have been able to make himself a danger to that car.
Isn't that true for any intoxicated person in an automobile? I mean, I'm concerned about the situation where, say, someone calls an Uber from a bar because they're intoxicated, does the thing that they're supposed to do to get a ride home, and they pass out in the car, and the Uber driver decides to stop at a convenience store, leaves the car running, and goes into the convenience store. And you've got an intoxicated passenger with a running car still sitting there. And I don't see any difference between that person and Mr. Moore. And that seems to, I mean, under that scenario, it seems that you're indicating that that person could be held responsible and have their license revoked because they're in physical control of the automobile. Is that the case?
Your Honor, again, I would point to the Starfield that it's the overall situation that is determinative. Here, it was Mr. Moore's vehicle that he was in, Ms. Appellant's vehicle. He was on his way from his cabin to his home in the Twin Cities with these other folks. At that time, when he went to sleep, he did not have a designated driver who he intended to be his driver for the remainder of that journey, which is, again, I would point to Starfield that it's the overall situation. So while a passenger in a car for an Uber who's doing what they should be doing, trying to avoid, at that point, you know, then the court could consider whether they at any point relinquished their passenger status by, you know, taking other affirmative steps that the court has addressed earlier. But
So the thing that makes this case different is it's his car?
It's his car, Your Honor, and his travel companions were a quarter of a mile away over the interstate. He knew that there was nobody He did not have a designated driver at the time that he went to sleep, and also the fact that the preponderance of the evidence shows that he can consider also that he admitted to the deputy that he did park the car. So it is more likely than not that he would have been in physical control at that time.
Can I clarify your position? So your position is that he was a passenger, but that he still was in physical control. Am I understanding correctly? And if so, I guess I'm wondering, is there any case law that that involves a passenger, somebody who is designated a passenger by the court or deemed to be a passenger, and then reaches the conclusion that there was physical control?
To address the first part of your question, Your Honor, about my position is that it is the cumulative effect. It is the decisions that were made up until the point that he was found by the officer, and my position is that at that point that he was found by the officer, he was in physical control of the car.
I thought you said he had. I thought you earlier said that he had relinquished control. Excuse me. Well, he had relinquished his driver, if he had it. If he was a driver, he had relinquished that status and he had become a passenger. Maybe I'm not accurately restating what you said, but I thought that was what you said or something to that effect. And I guess if that's the case, I'm wondering, you know, what case law can you rely on to reach your conclusion given passenger status?
Apologies, Your Honor. If I misspoke, if he had had assuming he had passenger status at any point when his friend was driving, the cumulative effect that relinquished that passenger status was.
I'm sorry. Relinquished passenger status, not relinquished driver status.
Yes.
So I misunderstood. So, I apologize.
Yes, so the relinquishment of the passenger status was, pointing to those cumulative facts and that it is more likely than not that he had relinquished the status. I would also point to...
By parking the car.
That's
the only thing?
By having the car pull over, it is also, the fact that he was sprawled throughout the car suggests the fact that he knew that he was alone in the car. And this court has found, I would note that in Shane, for example, as Judge Larkin brought up earlier, the court noted that a case is different when somebody is found alone in a car as opposed to... it is stopped when they are the passenger or there is the person who is, the driver who is right there. I would also note, as my time is expiring, I would request just briefly to conclude.
I have one question, counsel, and that is, if we do remand for additional factual findings, mm-hmm. Do you have a view as to whether the district court should reopen the record?
Your Honor, I do not think it is necessary, but if the district court does find it helpful, It could be helpful to get more factual findings, but
what about the two missing witnesses that were subpoenaed?
While their testimony may clear up or provide other testimony as to what happened between when the car got on the road and when the officer found it, there is also it is the commissioner's position that at the point in time when the deputy found him, the appellant was in physical control of the car as well. And just very briefly, this court has interpreted, I can recognize that there are dual interests here, and this court has recognized the fact that this is a remedial law and is interpreted in behalf of the public safety. Here we had somebody who was, without much difficulty, able to move into driving his car, continuing on his journey, and making his car a danger to himself and to the public. Because of that, the respondent asked that the district court order be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Just wait one moment. Go ahead, anytime.
Excellent. Thank you. In order to get right to the question that was asked on my direct, we can look and interpret Shane de novo in this case, and compare and contrast de novo, partly in fact to district court paragraph 52. I'm going to read that. That the actions of the other two occupants may have contributed to this situation, i.e. leaving Moore behind in the vehicle with the engine running, end paren, does not, in reviewing the relevant case law, negate the officer's probable cause. In that finding, the district court did interpret what the role of the other two, the involvement of the other two individuals in the situation was, that they got out of the car and left Mr. Moore in it while the vehicle was running.
I admit, counsel, I do not understand that sentence from the district court at all. Maybe that's just me, but I don't understand what that means. The actions do not, that may have contributed to the situation, does not negate probable. I don't understand.
Sure. That what we have is that is the passenger status, that's the district court acknowledging the passenger status. These two other individuals got out of the vehicle and were seen walking away from the vehicle when the emergency call came into 911. Okay, a couple other factors that were taken into evidence in the record include the weather. It was cold and rainy. It was an October day. Mr. Moore was in the vehicle with it running in the heat on. The other two decided to walk and stand out in the rain when the officer found them. There were other seats that were available in the vehicle. If they were in the passenger seat or if they were in the back seat, there wouldn't have been a need to get out. But when the officer found Mr. Moore, the driver's seat was vacated and the back seat was vacated with plenty of room. I asked the officer, was there any luggage or anything else in the back that would have prohibited those people from being in there? He said, no, it wasn't. So those are factors that the district court heard and considered. The other factors were the confusion that Mr. Moore had when awakened. He found himself alone in the vehicle, and it was his interaction with the officer that he believed one of the other passengers, the one that had been driving, had been taken into custody or was had been removed from the vehicle, and he was alone in the vehicle. That was upon the officer waking him up. Those facts we have. Now, the district court did not get into those facts in its analysis, but those were contained, that testimony and evidence is contained in the transcript and in the record. And so those facts are critical in comparing to the Shane case, where that in that situation, which is different, the driver of that vehicle was still seated in the vehicle at the time and was physically removed by law enforcement. So that is a contrasting factor. But what we do have is we have other people on the scene. I do not.
Counsel, are you aware of any case, published or unpublished, in which the rule of law from Shane was applied to in the defendant's favor? I note that the Supreme Court in Shane referenced the unique facts of this case and talked about, you know, any time the police are doing a traffic stop and order a passenger to remain in the car while they deal with the driver, the passenger is going to be in a position to start the car without much difficulty. I'm wondering how broadly Shane extends beyond the specific facts in that case.
Certainly.
Keeping in mind that I believe we have lots of case law saying when the police find someone passed out in the car, even if they're in the passenger seat, that's considered to be control of the vehicle.
Yes, and with respect to those situations, typically what you end up having is a vehicle in a place where it shouldn't be, and the occupant is the only one on the
Understood.
Scene.
We've got other people here. So any other cases applying Shane?
I'm looking at the Feist case, which was a recent 2022 case. Cited in my brief, I would have to check and see if Shane was analyzed in Feist. I believe so, but I'm recalling that's only from my recollection. So that would be the only thing is it's my belief without confirming it. So,
counsel, I see that your time has expired. I am for my own edification. What happened in the criminal proceeding, or was there a criminal proceeding?
Yes, there was. Mr. Moore was not he was not convicted of the criminal charge. Otherwise, a conviction would have made the implied consent challenge much easier for the state, in that they would have used the conviction as proof of So
he was found guilty of the charge, or not guilty?
The matter, well, for candor to the court, it was resolved on a stay of adjudication under an Alford plea. So it will be dismissed upon successful completion, if not already dismissed. But there was no, Mr. Moore did not enter a factual, under oath, a factual basis pursuant to the Alford plea. So the only information we have in the record is what, as to the conduct, is what's here.
All right, very good. Thank you very much. Counsel, thank you very much for your submissions. They were very helpful to the court. The matter is under taken under advisement. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.